The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic Traveler. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. On today's Armchair Traveler, we conclude our eight-part series as we visit the last of the best of the world 25 trips to take in 2020. This from the December 2019, January 2020, and final issue of National Geographic Traveler. Destination 25 is Canada's Magdalen Islands. Our writer guide is Jennifer Hayes, a marine biologist and photographer for National Geographic. And as Jennifer describes her trip, in a beautiful but diminishing world of ice, a photographer returns to document the harp seals that depend on it. Let's learn more as we travel with Jennifer to the Magdalen Islands. When you walk on sea ice, it's easy to forget there's an ocean below you. This frozen world is stripped down to essentials, impossibly blue sky, bright sun bouncing off a blanket of fresh snow, wind that vibrates like a cello, whiteness all around. Then I hear the distant chorus of infant cries and stand still for some time, listening. It's a precious moment that I want to appreciate fully before I pull out my cameras. I catch a slight movement in a ridge of snow ahead of me, a gentle and clumsy wave of a tiny flipper. I see a pup nestled inside a small snow cave, molded by body heat and movement, protected from the wind. Its coloring is still tinged with a hint of yellow from amniotic fluid. When it turns, I can see its thick pink placenta. I choose a spot a polite distance away and kneel in the snow, watching and waiting, making a note of the date, March 8, 2019. I hear sloshing water and short, grunting breaths before I see a whiskered face with big, dark eyes rise and survey the surroundings from a nearby hole in the ice. The female emerges, using curved claws to pull herself onto and across the ice to her pup. They meet with a nose-to-nose kiss of recognition that establishes kinship. Are you my pup? Are you my mother? The female turns to gauge my presence and determines I am no threat and settles onto her side, shuts her eyes, and begins to nurse. Welcome to the Harp Seal Nursery in the Gulf of St. Lawrence off the Magdalen Islands, Île de Madeleine, Quebec, one of the two Northwest Atlantic harp seal whelping grounds. Adult seals migrate here from the Arctic, with the pregnant females searching for suitable ice in which to give birth. Harp seals are an ice obligate species. They require a stable sea platform of ice for pups to survive. Born on the ice in late February and early March, the pups nurse for 12 to 15 days before being left on their own. The young seals are among the most captivating creatures on the planet, with obsidian eyes, charcoal noses, and cloud-soft fur. As I scan the ice cape, I see larger, more active pups in their white coat phase. These older pups, born days earlier, have the distinct advantage of time in the increasingly unpredictable world of climate change and its impact on the ice beneath them. Late-born pups especially need an adequate period of stable ice to survive in a world where spring comes earlier every year, and with it increasingly strong storms that demolish the ice pack like a blender. A life born to ice is difficult, and natural mortality is high. Add a season of increased temperatures and decreasing ice, and you have a deadly combination for the pups. The Magdalen Islands, or the Maggies, as some Canadians affectionately call them, are an archipelago of islets that resemble ships at anchor at the center of the Gulf of St. Lawrence. In 2011, a National Geographic assignment first took photographer and my partner David Dubelay and me to the Maggies for a story about the Gulf of St. Lawrence's marine ecosystem. The boat we boarded to meet the seals was a steel-hulled fishing and seal-hunting vessel. Magdalen Islanders have fished and hunted seal off these shores since the 1600s. It's a controversial tradition that continues today with strict quotas and regulations, no white coats, despite a substantial decline in the number of seals harvested due to decreasing market price and unfavorable ice conditions. Given the current market situation for hunting products, our guide, Mario Sear, told me ecotourism and observation tours are the best alternative for most boat owners and hunters. After 2 days of searching open water, the boat's captain nosed the vessel into a patch of sea ice, supporting a herd of more than 10,000 seals. We drifted there with the ice over several days and nights. It was extraordinary to pull on crampons and walk among this gathering of pulsating life on the ice and then put on a dry suit, mask, fins, and snorkel and slide into their world with a camera. Life at the edge of the patch can be a busy place, with mothers coming and going beneath a dark blue cathedral of ice, pierced by shafts of light, apprehensive white coats peering into the sea, considering their first swim, and veterans gliding about and exploring their new ocean world. Despite the challenge of finding the herd, the assignment was a photographic success, and it gifted me with a life-changing moment. Our last day on the ice, a mother seal swam to defend me from an aggressive male seal as I floated respectfully near her and her pup. The male nipped my ankles and scrabbled over my back, pushing me below the surface. She fought him off and then nudged both her and her pup and me through the water and out of harm's way. I was still processing what had happened as our ship got underway, heading back to port ahead of a building low-pressure system. The storm tore across the gulf, whipping it to froth and frenzy. By the time we made shore, we learned that the sea ice had disintegrated beneath the herd and the pups had been lost. Our commitment to the seals did not end after our story was published in 2014. The storm had made my encounter with the mother seal bittersweet and forced me to realize that we were now facing the new truth, that the world of ice was as fragile as a dream. The realization galvanized my resolve to return each year that ice conditions allow to track the harp seals' lives and connect with others, these creatures in their diminishing realm. Fast forward to 2019, Mario Sear called to cancel our boat charter for our annual visit to the seal nursery. The fishing boats were iced in, he noted. The silver lining, it was looking like a good year for the seals. The situation presented the perfect opportunity to finally explore helicopter-based harp seal ecotourism. The Chateau Madeleineau, located on Cape Almoulay, the Magdalen's main island, operates helicopters that take travelers over the pack ice during seal pup season, landing only if conditions are safe. Which is how I find myself watching the pup nursing as its mother soaks up the warm sun. I eventually walk back toward the helicopters. I see a girl sitting quietly next to a chubby white coat that stares intently back at her. Other travelers I meet include a couple on a Valentine's Day date, a cancer patient, and a Japanese photographer and guide celebrating his 30th year with the seals. There's the young lady who brought her toy seal from childhood and a 20-something man from Kingston, Ontario, who slept in his car and ate canned goods after spending his last dollar for the final helicopter ride of the season. Passion and curiosity brought them all here to learn, grow, and heal. Before my snorkeling encounter with the protective mother and her pup, I was a skeptic about human-wildlife interactions, but I now accept that sometimes things happen when we least expect it. Biologists can point out why a testosterone-fueled male seal was compelled to challenge me while I was swimming with his potential mate, but they cannot easily explain why a mother seal would push me to safety with her pup. I don't need explanations. I just embrace it. Well, included with Jennifer Hayes' article are some travel-wise tips. Should you like to consider visiting Magdalen Islands in Canada? The world of the Harp Seal isn't just for professional photographers or extreme adventurers. The Magdalen Islands are accessible by air, boat, or a ferry from Prince Edward Island. How to get there? Well, flights to Cape Almulay, the main island in the Magdalens, are less dependent on sea ice conditions, but of course are more expensive than the ferry. Air Canada Express operates flights from Montreal, Quebec City, and Gaspé. Pascan Airline is a local option, often booked by islanders. CTMA runs a year-round ferry service from the port town of Sardis on Prince Edward Island to Cape Almulay. The journey takes about 5 hours, and you can learn more about all these options for travel at traversiectma.ca. That's T-R-A-V-E-R-S-I-E-R. CTMA.A, TraversioCTMA.ca. How about things to do? Well, Madelineaux are as versatile as they are kind and spirited. The winter is a perfect time for a conversation about a fire and with craft beer in hand. And winter activities include cross-country skiing, ice sailing, or snow kiting. Hike the island's signature red sandstone cliffs year-round, maybe accompanied with a picnic of local cheeses and smoked herring, also artisan breads. And mid-Lent celebrations are a beloved and generations-old tradition in the Magdalens, full of music, costumes, and merrymaking. And you can learn more about that by tourismemilledelamadeleine.com. And here we go. I'm going to spell this one out for you. Ready? T-O-U-R... I-S-M-E-I-L-E-S-D-E-L-A-M-A-D-E-L-I-N-E. That's tourismemilledelamadeleine.com/en/discover-the-island/. How about how to see the seal pups? Well, how about live aboard boat? The Magdalen Islands are one of the only places on the planet allowing snorkeling and diving access to the secret world of the Harp Seal. A boat iced safari offers a luxury of time with the Harp Seals above and below the sea ice. Charters are generally available from late February through early March. Expeditions last an average of 6 days. The ice-capable fishing boats offer basic expedition-style accommodations, communal bunk space, galley, shared toilet, and local cuisine. Liveaboard boat expeditions are subject to the uncertainty of ice conditions, but they offer advantages not provided by daylight helicopter access. Unlimited time and light on the sea ice to experience sunrise, sunset, and twilight, diving and snorkeling in the sea ice with harp seals, encounters with other species that live on the ice pack, going to sleep with the sounds of the harp seal nursery echoing across the ice. Can you imagine that? Well, you can contact Mary O'Sear, a lifelong Madelineaux diver, photographer, filmmaker, and expedition guide, and all this at aquanauts.com/en/catalog/adventure/harp-seal-discovery. And I'll spell that first part out, Aquanauts, A-Q-U-A-N-A-U-T-E-S, aquanauts.com/en/catalog/adventure/harp-seal-discovery. Then we have the day excursion via helicopter. Hotel Madelineaux offers small group excursions via helicopter to search for the seal herd on the ice pack before heading out. Participants are briefed on harp seal biology, etiquette, and safety on the ice. Helicopters set down a safe distance away from the herd, and guests get out to explore the nursery. The experience lasts about 3 hours and is ice and weather dependent. And you can learn more at hotelsaccents.com/en/observations-des-blanchons, B-L-A-N-C-H-O-N-S. That's hotelsaccents.com/en/observations-des-blanchons, B-L-A-N-C-H-O-N-S. Talk about a lot of fun and a very unique trip. Wow, how about that? Well, as we've mentioned, National Geographic Traveler is no longer being published, and in its final issue, Editor-at-Large, Don George invited readers to take another trip, this one into the archives, to explore a world of wonders in National Geographic's basement. Have you ever thought about visiting a basement for a destination? Let's check it out. One day, the editor of Traveler called me up. "We've got a really exciting assignment for you," he said. "Far away places danced in my brain. Atukaki, Timbuktu, San Marcan." I asked for details. "Don," he began, "we'd like you to spend a week in the bowels of National Geographic." "I'm not sure I heard that correctly," I said. He continued, "We'd like you to spend a week exploring our photo archives. It's be a journey around the world and across the ages without ever leaving the basement. What do you think?" I thought, you want me to spend a week in a windowless room in the depths of a building in downtown Washington, D.C. with no sun, no fresh air, no cultural celebrations, no local feast? But after I pondered it for a day, curiosity got the better of me. It would be like exploring an uncharted wilderness, the metaphorical equivalent of journeying to the edges of Antarctica or the heart of the Amazon. In my mind, it became a grand adventure, the expeditions to Archivia. Who knew what treasures awaited in those air-conditioned bowels? Well, welcome to the National Geographic Photo Archives, one of the most significant photography collections in the world, Julia Andrews says exuberantly, opening the doors to her fluorescent-lit cellar. The room is about 36 feet by 36 feet. Most of this area is occupied by 14-foot-high accordion-style shelves that are filled with folders and boxes containing more than 10 million photographs, slides, glass negatives, and art. The only open space is a narrow corridor. On a far wall hangs a massive Treasure Island-like scene of pirates smoking a pipe. It was painted by N.C. Wyeth in 1914. The air is brittle, the temperature is cold, a wind is rattling from the air coolers. I've agreed to spend a week in this room. Now I'm here, and there's no way out. Andrews is my ambassador to Archivia. She's a red-haired whirlwind of expertise and enthusiasm, here to guide me through the wonders of this little visited wilderness. She hands me a pair of white cotton gloves. Where do you want to go? I ask Andrews to show me the oldest photo, which turns out to be an unremarkable shot of a mountain in the Caucasus. We look at 1880s postcard-style photos of Europe purchased on a four-year honeymoon by early National Geographic Society donors, Mr. and Mrs. Phelps, who, Andrews tells me, later divorced, and some evocative hand-tinted photos of Japan taken in 1914 by an intrepid American named Eliza Skidmore. The magic doesn't happen until the end of the day when I come upon a seemingly simple 1936 photo of Paris. The shot shows an artist who has set up his easel on a cobbled alley in Montmartre and is painting Sacré-Cœur, which looms dreamily in the distance. Suddenly, I'm transported to my own Parisian summer in 1975, to the cobbled alleys where I fell in love with the city, with France, and with life. It's like I've eaten a photographic Madeleine. Memories flood through me. I end the day tingling. How can one image taken eight decades earlier have that effect? Well, the next day I asked to see the photos from the 1909 Robert Peary expedition to the North Pole, which National Geographic sponsored. Andrew hands them to me, encased in the kinds of three-ring binders I used in high school, black and white snapshots, carefully inserted into plastic sleeves. But what snapshots? A ship surrounded by icebergs, members of the crew in their fluffy, furry polar gear. This is photography as scientific and historical record. These people were venturing where no one had gone before. These photos say to the world, this is where we were. This is who we were. This is what we saw. We bear witness. Cradling the photos in my white-gloved hands, I feel a frisson. I'm holding history. And what's more, in this frustratingly cold cellar, it's somewhat easier to imagine a penetrating Arctic chill. Now I want to show you some autochromes, Andrews says. These were the first color photos. They used grains of potatoes starched, dyed red, green, and blue on a glass plate. The first autochrome appeared in National Geographic in 1914. Take a look at these shots of ballet taken by Franklin Price Knott in 1928. She hands me a box filled with 4-inch square glass plate images. I put them on a light table, and another world leaps to life. 17 young women in brilliantly patterned red, green, yellow, and black skirts, a dance troupe in gold gowns and headdresses, 2 women balancing ceremonial towers of fruit as tall as they are on their heads. I imagine National Geographic readers in Iowa, Texas, and Maine opening their monthly magazine to find page after page of such images. How must this portfolio have fired their imaginations? Bill Bonner is a lanky man whose bright eyes and wispy gray-brown ponytail give him a wizardly appearance. He presided over the photo collection for almost 34 years until his retirement in 2016. One of the keys to unlocking Archivia is knowing Bonner. Bonner managed a collection that contained about 10.5 million images taken up to the 1990s. We had nearly 500,000 black and white prints going back to the 1870s, about 12,000 illustrations, hand-tinted black and white prints, and one of the largest collections of autochromes in the world. It's one of the biggest, most comprehensive records of the world anywhere, he tells me. Voluminous and important indeed, but is it representative? I ask. Is it an honest look across the board? No. But these photographers were showing locations that the average person couldn't get to. You're seeing people going about their lives, people like us just doing their thing. All these moments have been preserved. I asked Bonner what he thinks about the archive's significance. I'm not a traveler, but I saw the whole world through these pictures. I saw so many people, and I traveled through time in a way. There's something about it that made me sad. I found myself wanting to go there, and by there I meant more in time than in space or place, to that very moment in the image. But that moment is gone. The archives is a sacred place for me, he says. Good morning. Today we're going to Papua New Guinea. I want you to see these photos taken in 1921 by Captain Frank Hurley, Andrew says. The Papua New Guinea files are located under Guinea, New British. And as she maneuvers one of the metal staircases into the stacks, one of its wheels squeaks like bird calls in the jungle. A river of images seems to flow through my gloved hands, a gauntlet of indigenous men welcoming the photographers to their village. The eyebrow-raising caption reads, 2 rows of cannibals formed a narrow guard of honor down which we passed. Elaborately carved shields and layers of skulls, a warrior with a headdress of teeth and an oblong shell as big as his face attached to his lower lip, a woman with a fantastically feathered headdress, a broad neck plate, necklaces of teeth slung bandolier style under her breast, and an 8-inch long stick pierced through her nasal septum. While the world has evolved in its sensibilities, these are the images I remember from my childhood when I plundered stacks of neatly piled yellow-framed magazines in my parents' basement. National Geographic was never thrown away like other magazines. It was kept like a museum piece. We had invested something of ourselves in those pages. We honored them and treasured them. For better or worse, saving issues of National Geographic has evolved from a tradition to a trope. When people hear that I'm an editor-at-large for Traveler, they inevitably say, "Oh, I love your magazine. We have piles of them in our basement." And here I am in National Geographic's basement. It strikes me that Archivia is a metaphor for the basements around the world where stacks of yellow-bordered magazines sit like religious relics. I look at the photos in front of me and think of Bonner's words. While not a perfect collection, these are living images. They capture and preserve pieces of the world's mosaic. Then I think of Bémion. Ever since I'd seen photographs, no doubt in National Geographic, of the colossal Buddha statues at Bémion in Afghanistan, I vowed to go there one day. Sadly, I never made it, and in 2001, the Taliban dynamited the ancient statues, obliterating them for eternity. But not in Archivia. Andrews wheels the stairway into the stacks and descends with a bulging folder. There they are, the Buddhas of Bémion. They live again, and I transport myself to them, feel the sun, the dusty wind, hear the braying of donkeys in the foreground. The next photo takes my breath away. It shows the 170-foot-tall main Buddha in a cliffside niche. A man stands at its base, barely as tall as its sandaled foot. It is astonishing to think of the size and scale of the statue carved so many centuries before, and it is staggering to contemplate its loss. Julia, I want you to go to Machu Picchu, I announced one morning. She beckons me into the canyon between the two towering stacks of shells. Geological layers of documentary expedition surround us as she points me to a long stretch packed with a type of photo albums my parents would lovingly prepare after every vacation. This is Machu Picchu, Andrew says, waving her hand dramatically over 24 albums. Wow, isn't that amazing? I left an antiquated leather-bound book and delicately open it. Four black-and-white photos approximately 3 inches tall by 6 inches wide are meticulously laid out and taped, two to a page. I behold Machu Picchu when it was a jumble of vines and trees and rocky ground, and then the same area a month later with walls and windows and paths clearly visible. The excursion is different for me because I've been to Machu Picchu. I've walked these paths, traced these walls, imagined what it was like to be Hiram Bingham exploring the so-called lost city of the Incas in 1911, and later, with funding from the National Geographic Society, documenting its treasures. Then I come to a photo of Intihuatana Stone, the place where the sun is tied, which the Inca used to measure the passage of time. I have stood at this exact spot, goosebumps, and I think of the Intihuatana when the Inca first built it some 600 years ago, and then when it was overwhelmed by jungle, and when Hiram Bingham was guided to it by an 11-year-old boy who knew the site well, and then wherein I stood there. I think of all the ambition, history, and belief concentrated in this place. The wind rustles the grasses around me. I sense a llama to my left, visitors and scrambling over ruins to my right. Somewhere I hear a voice calling, "Don, Don, it's time to go home now." On my last day in Arcadia, I joined the Apollo 11 moon mission 50 years ago. As I gaze at the photo of Buzz Aldrin and the American flag on the lunar surface, I think about the future. Where are we headed? Another photo catches my eye, Earth seen from outer space, looking at our marble spinning in the immeasurable universe. I think about the journeys I've made in Arcadia, the places I've been, the people I've met, and I think about Bill Bonner. I realize that I'm feeling what he felt during those decades in this worldly basement. Arcadia is a planetary photo album, a lovingly curated collection of moments that reveal how vast and fleeting impressions. Precious is this terrestrial sphere, our own sacred place. We can explore it with care or ignore it at our peril. The choice is ours. I choose to travel. Editor-at-large Don George sharing his secret week-long visit to the fantastic photo collection at the archives at National Geographic in Washington, D.C. By the way, Don is the author of an acclaimed anthology, The Way of Wanderlust, the best travel writing of Don George. The last page of this final edition of Traveler is called Sacred Beauty. It's a short essay about Devil's Tower. While working in a National Geographic cover story, Traveler contributing photographer Aaron Huey accompanied 9-year-old Joaquinian Two Bulls Above and his mother as they looped prayer ties to a tree near Mato Tipala, the Lakota name for the butte known as Devil's Towers, and it's formed by magma some 50 million years ago, and you can still see it in northeast Wyoming. Quite an interesting excursion. Well, that brings us to the end of today's Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed your journey. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.